Am I unmuted? Well, welcome back, everyone, and I hope you've had a beautiful break. And I'm sure there's lots of stirrings happening within your heart. And in this time now, for about roughly the hour, and then we want to move into groups. A bit less than an hour. We can only really, in a way, touch on this very, very, very big topic. But I think, again, really, really important in terms of our spiritual journey, this wounded sensuality and mystical union. It seems to me that this whole sense that we were with yesterday of Julian reminding us, God is in our sensuality. Our sensuality is holy. And that in our sensuality we are one in the Christ. And that what's important for us is that our sensual self is one to our, what she calls our substantial self, or our inner heart, our heart, our naked self, our unselfed self, that part of us that's in God, that our substance and sensuality is one. What's happened in life is that a split starts to take place. So we move out of the natural oneing, in which we're one in the Christ, in the union, if you like, of humanity and divinity, just as the Christ is united in humanity and divinity. And of course, with that separation, that splitting that takes place, that creates a sort of scatteredness. And it's out of that wound that's often full of shame. There's something about sexual wounding that immediately gets cloaked in shame. So it gets pushed down into the into our unconscious, into our shadow. And if it's not attended to, in this same very, very gentle, loving, tender way, it rises up out of the unshadow and does the sort of damage that it's been doing. And we know only too well, don't we, that within the Christian tradition, this has become a serious and major catastrophe. And it seems to me that it's all about the distortion of the desire for God. And that this sense of the original kiss that we dwell within, and the eros and the passion of the Trinity that we all have, that is infinitely holy, somehow life distorts that or disturbs that. And if life depends on, and we would all have some sexual wounding, but some, of course, a lot more serious than others. So in terms of very, very serious sexual wounding, then, you know, what happens is our whole self, our whole being gets destroyed, and our whole capacity to hold boundaries, our whole capacity to risk finding our essence, because that ground of trust versus mistrust is so seriously disturbed. Thought we might start with this very powerful image of St. Francis. And some of you might go, oh! but the more I stay with it, the more I think, it says something about our woundedness, and particularly maybe our sexual wounds, because there's something about sexual wounding that the language and it starts to get very, very painful or very, very difficult, because it's so locked in the shadow again. And what I love about Francis is that he was so one with the Christ that the wounds of one became the wound of the other so profoundly that they actually became an energetic body experience for Francis. And the way in which Francis was able, you know, to kiss the leper, to to kiss the wound of the crucified one in this image, but to kiss the letter, to be wounded himself in such a way that brought him into this exquisite oneness with the Christ. That, I think, is the gift that we're longing to give each other, so that we can be with ourselves in those sorts of wounds, and if we're spiritual companions, that we can companion others in them, so that we're able to just be whole in that tender love, and to just create the sacred womb space, the sacred heart space, where whoever we're companioning or whoever we're with can be how they need to be, in all the vulnerability, in all the fear, and in all the shame that might arise in our experience. So I just thought that that was a powerful image for us too. And so this sense of, you know, what happens to us, sorry, moving too fast. What happens to us when our heart's been wounded like this, where life has betrayed us, where the ground of trust has been taken from us and we don't know what to do. Well, what I found myself in my own journey was that, without even realizing, is that when we've got a very wounded heart, and it's often unconscious, is the first thing we do is go in for self-protect. And so, again, fairly early in my life, I came to this realization that I had this sort of profound wound in my heart, like somebody had taken a knife and stabbed me. And what I had done is I'd got quite a lovely gold thread and wrapped it right around my heart and around and around and around. And I remember one retreat realizing that this wound was there and that there was this thread that was protecting it. And in the retreat with the beloved, getting the thread and taking hold of the thread. And as I pulled, and it was just like miles and miles and miles of thread that had been wrapped around. And of course, as that happens, and again, I was in a very safe environment in that situation, as that happens, then what happens is this wound, well, first of all, my heart starts to be able to breathe, but also one realizes how vulnerable that wound is, and that really needs to be tended with care, and that the beloved is there to be in the tending, and right in the very depths and in the middle of this wound, there is love. So what I'm sort of focusing on a little bit in this is then for us to begin to be able to notice, in terms of my image, or, you know, sometimes people have very strong images, like put up a brick wall. And sometimes we can meet people and there's like a brick wall because they just don't want to be hurt. Now, if we do this to ourselves, first of all, it makes us unwell at a health level. Secondly, though, when we've got all of that dynamic going, we're not going to be able to do the sort of yielding that I've been just talking about in the dark night. So we just basically keep ourselves pretty busy, pretty distracted, life goes on, and we stay disconnected from the wound. And of course, that's the culture we live in. And we certainly don't give people permission to take time to grieve or to take some time to do some inner work. And I think that that's really, really critical. This is a passage I've always found really powerful every time I've really been dealing with a major trauma in my life. Because I think, again, what it does is it brings up shame. And, you know, there are times in our lives where we just do get it wrong. Or someone has done something to us that has been really very, you know, really quite rape-like. Either, you know, rape of our being or our psychological well-being or our physical well-being, or, you know, unfortunately, more and more rape of our soul, that, you know, that we have experiences where life has been, you know, harsh, and we need to be able to weep, we need to be able to grieve, but we need to be with someone in a loving way that can sit with us. So at these sorts of times, I've always found this particular passage from Ezekiel really powerful, because it speaks of a young woman, obviously, because I'm feminine, but a young man, who's cloaked in shame. And I think when we get in touch with this part of ourselves, this is what it's like. Then I passed by, and I saw you kicking about in your blood. And as you lay there in your blood, I said to you, live. I made you grow like a plant of the field. You grew and developed and entered puberty. Your breasts had formed and your hair had grown, yet you were stark naked. Later I passed by, and when I looked at you, I saw that you were old enough for love. Sorry. I spread a corner of my garment over you and covered your naked body. I gave you my solemn oath and entered into a covenant with you, declares the Holy One, and you became mine. I bathed you with water and washed the blood from you and put ointments on you. I clothed you with an embroidered dress and put sandals of fine leather on you. I dressed you in fine linen and covered you with costly garments. I adorned you with precious jewels. I put bracelets on your arms and a necklace around your neck. And I put a ring on your nose, earrings on your ears, and a beautiful crown on your head. So you were adorned with gold and silver. Your clothes were of fine linen and costly fabric and embroidered in cloth. Your food was honey, olive oil, and the finest flour. You became very beautiful and arose to be a queen. And your fame spread among the nations on account of your beauty, because the splendor I have given you made your beauty perfect, declares the Compassionate One. And so in that, we became one with the Compassionate One. I want to go back, and the author uses some powerful imagery there. Again, you see a lot of this come up in Clare of Assisi, where again in that beautiful emptiness, somehow the luminosity of the love, you know, she describes in these same sorts of imageries. Notice too how a lot of these images connect very much with some of the descriptions of wisdom in the books of wisdom. And also I think what's important here is how sensual the language is, very, very sensual. So if we're companioning people or with ourselves in wherever we might be most vulnerable, and where we feel ourselves perhaps lying in a pool of blood, naked, bare, exposed, made fun of, belittled, or our boundaries violated, or someone actually trying to destroy us in some way, or someone with a sort of distortion that they think it's love, but in actual fact, what the very thing that they're doing is actually destroying our capacity to grow up. How beautiful it is, I think, if we can create an atmosphere immediately for someone, that this is where the beloved is, and the beloved's saying, live. Your naked body is beautiful. I love you. When I gaze at you, all I see is love. And the Holy One's saying, and you are mine. not in a way that keeps us separate and distant, but in the way that the Holy One, the Beloved, takes us into the Beloved Self and we become one. Takes us into the Beloved Self in the very wounding itself and we become one. What I've found in my own experiences of working with people who have had sexual wounding is that usually, and this is not always the case, but often enough, it is quite very, very, very important to be able to draw on God is in our sensuality, that our sensuality is holy and divine, our sexuality is holy, that it's critical that in the very place where wounding has taken place, that that we find that holiness. Also, in terms of that, then we might find that as the healing starts to take place and we're able to be held in that tender embrace, that the expressions of the healing will have a very, very sensual sense to it. In fact, they could well be quite sexual. So that's really important. And again, then, if that's taking place, like someone might come and say, you know, I've just had an experience of the Beloved making love with me. And this might be someone who's perhaps been through some form of sexual wounding or even as serious as a rape. The Beloved's making love in the very place where the wound is, where the wound is. So often for people in this situation to, and again, I'm talking about in a retreat situation, really, in a way. If we're going to do this sort of companioning with someone, well, we need to have had some, you know, experience and help and supervision to be doing it. That would be critical, absolutely critical. And some background in how to do this. That would be absolutely essential. But now what was I going to say about that? That was an aside. I know, yes. What's usually unhelpful, but not always, again, is though some of the language, say, of abyss or annihilation, because that language immediately can, like that sense that something takes place if we go through a wound like that, that we feel like we're annihilated. And if someone is sort of not had the opportunity to really meet the Beloved in the sensual experience and then just be pushed beyond it into a sort of annihilating language, that can actually be very unhelpful. So that for a lot of people in these situations, what they're really wanting to do and needing to do is to discover a self, to discover their own egoic identity as beautiful. So in other words, myself as a girl, as a woman, as a teenager, that, you know, I've got, for example, I have an image of myself, teacher's college, and in this room, and it's dirty and it's horrible and dark, and just feeling like this lonely, lonely girl, quite sad and pathetic, really, in this dark, dirty, dingy, horrible room. And then on that particular retreat, just staying with that, with my companion, being in it, being in what was going on in the heart and the betrayal and the confusion of the teenage Kerry. And then gradually, as I'm able to stay in the love in that, feeling like that room just fell down like a pack of cards. And I still have an image of that young teenager. She had a red and white check gingham top on and jeans. And, you know, sometimes life happens and you go through, you know, we go through betrayals, don't we, over and over again. And I need to check, is the Kerry in this red gingham top, how is she in this? So that she's grown now and she's usually all right. And if she's not, well, I'll tend to her immediately. because if she's not, things are going to get over kilter, out of kilter. So you know, that teenage part of our souls that isn't sure what it means to be a woman or a man, who is looking for love, doesn't know where to find it, gets betrayed, you know, over and over, and all of that sort of stuff. So we find who that is in ourselves, and then we tend it. For some people, they're quite happy to bring that part of themselves to Jesus. I was. And again, in the same sorts of experience, I just had this sense one day that wounded lover on the cross and I, we were crucified together, and the wounds were one. And the bleeding was one bleeding. And but for a lot of people, and this is the great tragedy, the whole sense of the Christ and the crucifixion has been abusive in itself. At its very worst, it's actually been used as in a sexual way, which has absolutely destroyed any sense of the Christ being able to be the healer in that. And if that's the case, then we really need to draw on feminine imagery. For some, the Christa, the feminine Christa, will is okay. But for others, no Christic imagery at all needs to be wisdom or compassion, mercy. So that's part of the journey in terms of companioning people, is hearing, is where is the safe ground for us now? So we need to be so careful that we're not bringing an image of a, you know, this mighty God, Lord of all and power of all might and all the carry-on to these sorts of woundings, because all they do is put another layer of distortion and power abuse on the wounds. So this sense of being picked up from in the blood, picked up, sat with in the blood, or sat within the dirt of the dark, shabby room, whatever the image might be. But, you know, that's really critical, I think, for us to be able to do that. And so what I think is critical too for this is that these tears of humanity, these tears of all of our woundedness in humanity, are divine tears. That the divine is weeping with us in terms of wanting us to come into the ground of love and to realize that here is the divine sitting right in the midst of this with tears, you know. And so this vulnerable God, the one who is in the depths of every human vulnerability, there's absolutely nowhere that the divine beloved isn't and can't be. And that right in the very midst of our sexual wounding, there is the eros of the beloved, wanting to feel what was disturbed or shut down, oppressed. The beloved's wanting to be with us in the deepest sense of compassion by being one with us. So that all of our tears and all of our wounding and whatever our story might be become jewel tears for the wedding. So this wounded desire, that this yearning that we have for God and sexual wounding, that so often I think within the, you know, Christian tradition, if we look particularly at the number of clergy abuses, that often this is, I think, part of this is, I mean, very, very complex, of course, but from our point of view, looking at it from a spiritual point of view, is wounded desire. What do we do with our desire for God? And that very often as young people, within the way in which theology was taught, is that we had a God out there, a distant God, and, you know, I'm a young adolescent, trying to sort out who I am sexually, and that sort of gets distorted, and it's certainly not channeled into my love of God. And so it gets locked into the shadow, into the shame, and then it starts to come out and be, you know, as we know, any number of stories that you can read on the internet. What's really critical then, I think, in this wounded desire is that we reclaim our desire, our eros for God. And that we, once we really claim that that desire is the divine desire, and that we can be in the felt sense of that desire, that eros, that passion within us, then we can get a sense too of where, you know, where is it like almost like a thread's getting split off that, because there's so many, you know, what you might call deviant ways of expressing sexuality that's normalized within our culture. But we need to knit that back in again, embrace, bring it in, and bring it in to the original divine desire. So we need to meet distorted eros with divine eros and knit in that situation. That seems to me to be critical. And so we can look at all sorts of rules and regulations about abuse and power and how we might keep people safe sexually. But actually, if we don't do this inner work, we never will. It'll just find another way to come out. So at the moment, tragically, it seems to me, we're putting an awful lot of money and time into creating an atmosphere that's just going to keep reproducing the same thing. So what we're needing to do is to be very much in touch, I think, with the pure holiness of our own divine sexuality. And that intimacy within the Trinity of total interpenetrating one another, and that's theological language, is incredibly sexual, actually. And that it's incredibly beautiful. And that those of us who have been lucky enough to have beautiful experiences in relationships that are healthy and loving, that is an expression of divine desire. And that needs to be honoured and celebrated. Again, I think in our tradition it's not. It's seen as a very second-rate way of living. And in actual fact, it's a deep, deep expression of Trinitarian love. So this wounded desire, and you know, the psalmist, our soul's yearning and thirsting and pining, and all the language of desire that you know we can conjure up, all of that I think is critical to this healing, this wounding. And so part of this is the embracing and holding memories, and at the same time are remembering, in that we can, in a way, forget and forgive. But as I was saying before, it is one dark night. Like, all of these experiences are still part of us. But we're not living out of the little hurt girl. If I go back to my little girl in the room, who's about 19, I don't live out of her. She's part of me and I love her, and she's grown up now. But she's still 19, but she's contented, she's happy, she's cared for. In some ways I can forget it unless something triggers it. And I live from the integrated space of the oneing in the kiss of the divine. And I love the way in which Beatrice Brutto talks about forgiving. She says, forgive. We give our love into the future for the sake of the evolutionary movement into the divine. You know, I can't stand, because I did a lot of life's healing journeys and things like that within the retreat centre. And I can't stand this idea that, you know, oh, something like, you know, you just experience soul rape and someone says to you, well, can you forgive them? Just about want to explode, don't you? Doesn't work like that, you know. It doesn't work like that. We need to be able to be in the depths of our own wounding and to find that eros and that passion. And out of that, we give into the future. We pour out love to the person who's wounded us. But we need to do the work first. We need to have our own experience and the pain and the hurt of that experience honored before we even... And so often within the Christian tradition, this quick forgiveness sort of stuff, I think, again, stunts us. Very, very unhelpful. But it's really, if we can touch this divine eros, I think that gives us the power to live forgiveness. But we need to touch that from within the depth of our own wound, within our own vulnerability. So in other words, if we're back with the little girl who's in the pool of blood, telling her to forgive the person who put her in the pool of blood is not helpful. She needs to be able to be in that in a mature way with somebody who can sit in the blood with her and let her be how she needs to be until she can start to awaken and start to see, actually, there's something else here. There's love here, and love's touching you. Love's gazing and beholding and seeing your beauty. Love wants you to rise and find your voice. Very many of us within the Christian tradition too have had our voices squashed. And I've got any number of these images I've had socked down my throat for many years. Anyway, that's enough of all that. So I mentioned this before in terms of this sense of becoming lost in abandonment. So we want to be able to sit with the little girl in the blood, but we do not want to place her there and leave her there. There needs to be somebody sitting with her who's been in the blood, but also who knows, who's sensitive enough to where the story's unfolding, to perhaps point out where she might gaze, or who's gazing at her, or who's touching her, or that there's more to this story than our original. I love the way Julian of Norwich symbolises this. She says, there's a little servant who all the little one wants to do is to love and do the will of the, and this is a lord and servant thing, a feudal story, the love of the lord, the feudal lord. And the servant accidentally falls over and lands in a dell, and it tosses about and writhes about because it's so blind, because it can't see love. And so Julian's whole revelation is about how all the Lord is wanting to do is to see that the Lord only ever gazes with love. This whole story is about love. And notice that it's an accident. We accidentally fall in the dell all the time. And all the Beloved wants us to see is this dell can be a dell of our own destruction, if you like, or it can be a womb of love. If we have the people around us that can support us and enable that womb to be, the dell to become a womb, the womb where the birthing takes place. So very important, I think, not, you know, to be very aware of becoming lost in abandonment. Yes, we need to feel the pain and we need to feel it deeply. But there is a moment too where I think we need to be able to just gently and lovingly tended and perhaps encouraged and supported to know how to come up out of the darkness, or go deeper into the light, whichever image you're using. So just in terms of a few things then about power abuse, a lot of what I'm talking about here does arise out of power abuse. All of this, what we've found with the distortion of power is a lot of sexual wounding comes out of power abuse, power over someone. incapacity to consider that somebody else is my equal. We've just got this magnificent downpour of rain. I hope you'll be able to still hear me. It's fabulous. So what was they saying about a power? Yes, I think one of the major things that's causing power abuse within the church is our sense of the image of God, and this is particularly the case within the Roman tradition, where we still have operating out of a theology where the image of God, the priest, is in the persona Christi, in the image of Christ, and Christ is a male. So the distortion in that theology I could spend a week on, but I won't. But the point about the Christ is that the Christ is male and female are oned, perfectly oned in the Christ, into the wholeness of the all in all. And that within the tradition then there's such a distortion of the feminine and the feminine divine, and that distortion is maintained to such a point that there's no equality within the church whatsoever, and can't be until I think we come back to this original ontological identity. And so until we can all come to the point where we know that we're all knit and one in this knot of love in the divine, in the eros of the divine lovers, and it's actually got nothing to do with whether we're male or female, and that the journey is in integrating into that beautiful pure oneness, so that we can be absolutely sensually and sexually a woman or a man in all the beauty of that, in our own unique identity of that, in the oneing, then the power abuse victim language is going to continue. And so that the problem with the issue is really is all of the theology that's operating is operating out of a false dualism in the first place, and that's really what's creating all this spiritual violence and abuse. Also, I just wanted to bring up this whole notion of soul rape, again, I think it comes out of this whole sense of, you know, you really, and I've certainly had these experiences myself, where entering into that ground, that pure ground of the beloved, and really with every ounce of desire and eros of my heart, longing to live out of that and claiming that identity in the divine, what a threat that is to people. And how then people will often try, unhappy, disturbed people will try to destroy you through your reputation, or through eliminating you, trying to close your voice, trying all sorts of ways in which this soul rape takes place. Also to the point where I think sometimes the hatred of people that they don't want, they just do not want evolution to continue, and it's all locked in the shadow, and the hatred creates such energy field that we can actually feel ourselves quite almost attacked, really, and we use the language of attacked by the counter spirit, we might say. We're attacked by evil, we might say. And I would want to suggest that is actually accurate, that the energy feels, and that's when we start to know, we get to know chi energy, we get to know light heart energy, we know what energies we can trust, and that whenever we're going deeper and deeper and deeper into this divine, what we will find is this very powerful counter movement that is ruthless in trying to destroy us, and becomes more and more subtle. But I still feel it comes out of the same place of this distorted and false doctrine of the image of God, that somebody else has the right to have power over somebody else. We are all one. in the Christ, in the Trinity. We are all equal. It's just total nonsense to be talking in any other way. And so this masculine, feminine split that you see, particularly in the Roman tradition, but has its own face, I know, in some of the other Christian traditions too, that are much more enlightened than my own Roman tradition. It's exceedingly destructive. And it over and over and over again, it just tries to put us back in that pool of blood. And so I think that's part of the journey, is that we know that every time that happens to us, and it is, and we go into the pool and it has its own various versions of it, it's a call to deeper intimacy and to a deeper claiming of our ontological ground in the beloved. And often out of the depths of those sorts of experiences, something quite beautiful emerges. So sometimes we can offer our desire and our goodwill and our love and our ability to something, and in the Christian tradition they simply don't want it. And then they set out basically to make sure you can't do it. So all of us, I think, have had experiences of that. So again, we could go on and on, couldn't we? But I want to keep moving. I think I've given you a taste of it, and I'm sure you've got your own versions. What I want to do now is look at a couple of people, Meister Eckhart in particular, and Tayan. I think they've got a couple of very beautiful things to say about suffering. When we enter into the depths of our own suffering, Meister Eckhart says, what we discover is that God is our suffering. So this whole thing is, you know, why does suffering happen to good people? Or why am I suffering? Or God's doing this to me? Or I deserve this? Or all this nonsense. What Eckhart's saying to us is, God is so in your suffering. God is so part of that movement of love within whatever your experience, that the God is the suffering itself. And this is his little passage, and then I've got a quote from someone just to point this out. And this is this, he's making some points. This is the seventh point he's making about suffering. This book of Divine Consolation is really quite beautiful. The seventh point about the saying that God is with us in suffering and suffers with us is, we should be profoundly comforted by the fact of God's being purely one without any adventurous quantity or of difference, even in thought, so that everything that is in God is God in God's self. And since this is true, I say, whatever a good person suffers for God's sake, she or he suffers in God, and God is with her or him in their suffering. If my suffering is in God, and God suffers with me, how then can my suffering be painful when suffering loses its pain, and my pain is in God, and my pain is God? In truth, as God is truth, and wherever I find truth, I find my God, the truth, so likewise, neither more nor less, whenever I find pure suffering in God and for God, there I find God, my suffering. Whoever cannot understand this should blame his or her own blindness, not me, and not God, with God and God's loving kindness. So it's powerful, isn't it? I like it too. I think it's quite profound, really. So, you know, Eckhart also says to us, can we live without a why? Like, all these why questions take us into our head again, come down into the depths of our suffering, and there we meet God, and we realise God's in the depths of this, in our suffering. And of course, as soon as we're in that, we're in the energy flow of Paschal mystery. And the Christ is there drawing us, whether we might be carrying the cross, being nailed on it, hanging out exposed in our wounded vulnerability, or whether we're in the tomb, lost in darkness. We can tap in. As soon as we touch, it's just that shift in awareness. God is my suffering. God is this pain. This is drawing me into the intimacy of the kiss of the mystical marriage. It's not saying we need to and want to eliminate suffering. On the contrary, it's saying if we enter into it in this particular way, we will find the path of the Paschal mystery that takes us into healing. So there's a very interesting article by a fellow called Donald Tolglow, and it was actually written back in the 80s. It's in Theological Studies. And he writes about this idea of my suffering is in God and my suffering is God. God is not only our fellow sufferer, but our very suffering somehow becomes divine, he says. I think that's beautiful. So my very sexual woundedness somehow becomes divine. That's the truth of it. And that's what makes us compassionate lovers. And that's when we can start to have a really good relationship with anybody in a very unconditional way. So Eckhart, Dunklow speaking about Eckhart, in this drive toward the radical unity prior to the Trinity, so notice too, the one-ing, the one, and this one is before the Trinity, this absolute pure naked oneness. This drive toward the radical unity prior to the Trinity itself, all distinctions are overcome. Here, suffering and consolation, pain and joy, coincide. For since God suffers so willingly with us and for our sake, if we suffer only for the love of God, God suffers without suffering. Suffering is for God so joyful that it is for God not suffering. And therefore, if we thought rightly, suffering would not be suffering for us. It would be our joy and our consolation. Divine unity thus underlies the psychological coincidence of suffering and comfort. Because delight and suffering are one in God, we too suffer without suffering as we penetrate the divine unity. Now, I'm sure you've seen that in experiences with people. I have a beautiful friend that I accompanied in her cancer. And there was, you know, went through the most purgative of dark nights. But then she came to this beautiful sense of, as the barrenness, the dryness, the pain, the fear, the opaqueness, the suffering became God. The suffering, and that again took her into the oneing, into the luminosity, into the light, into the communion. And that's what I think is the gift we can give those who have been sexually wounded, if we can be with them in this way. That our suffering becomes divine, and that our sexuality is holy, it is divine. When we've encountered it within the eros of the divine desire. And just perhaps finish with one more. This is pretty famous, you probably know this very well, but this is Tyard in all his beauty saying, when the signs of age begin to mark my body and still more touch my mind, when the ill that is to diminish me or carry me off strikes from without or is born within me, when the painful moment comes in which I suddenly awaken to fact that I am ill or growing old, and above all, at that last moment, when I feel I'm losing hold of myself and am absolutely passive within the hands of the great unknown forces that have formed me. In all those dark moments, O God, grant that I may understand that is you who are painfully parting the fibres of my being in order to penetrate to the very marrow of my substance and bear me away within yourself. And we might just finish with Teilhard's beautiful pensées, very similar. In order to take possession of me, my God, you who are so much more remote in your immensity and so much deeper in the intimacy of your indwelling, you take to yourself and unite together the immensity of the world and the intimate depths in the intimate depths of my being. And I am conscious of bearing deep within me all the strain and the struggle of the universe. Lord, I do not just passively give way to these blessed passivities. I offer myself to them actively, and I do all I can to promote them. If I seal up the entry to my heart, I must dwell in darkness. And not only I, my individual soul, but the whole universe. If on the other hand my heart is open to you, then at once through the pure intent of my will, the divine must flood into the universe, and so far as the universe is centered on me. Since by virtue of my consent, I shall become a living particle of the body of Christ. All that affects me must in the end help in the growth of the total Christ. Christ will flood into me and over me and my cosmos. So in the wound of our most vulnerable sexual wounds, may the Christ flood into us all wisdom, Sophia, feminine wisdom, flood into us and into the whole of the cosmos so that we know how loved we are. So that's all big.
Amen.
Feels big. I'm inviting you now to move into your